We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right.
We're just amusing ourselves over here. Don't mind. Give us any mind.
All right.
It's Humpfest weekend.
As long as you keep to yourselves.
But all not right. In this studio.
No. All right. Well, speaking of Humpfest, we just got through election.
Yes.
Does that mean we all got screwed? Or?
No.
just wondering. So, what do you think about the election, Maria?
Well, it was a very, very interesting election. We're going to talk for a couple minutes about the results of the election, or the results so far, with most of the votes counted. The two ballot measures, Proposition 1, the King County Veterans and Human Services levy, was approved by a mile, which was nice to see, which also proves that even in a downturn, people know what's important and what they need to fund. On the other hand, Referendum 1 was approved by almost 60%. That was an uphill battle from the start, I think. But it also kind of shows, too, that in a primary in the middle of August, when you've got something like 30% turnout in the city of Seattle, then it can be really, really hard for you to get a good sense of what of whether people support something or not.
Well, I think, again, I have to be careful what I say because I'm also involved in a city council campaign. But I think there are a lot of people who are were just tired of it and wanted to see it over. And between that and the massive amount of money that the pro-tunnel people poured into the campaign, those both made a big difference. But there was a silver lining to that outcome, I think, which is that prior to the campaign, you had an awful lot of state officials saying that Seattle would be on the hook for cost overruns. A lot of them changed their tune. Particularly state legislative people,
right before the
and
vote, yeah.
and some of the other political leaders in the run up to the election, so that they are not now on the record saying that Seattle would not be on the hook for cost overruns for this tunnel. That's an accomplishment that can be specifically traced to the filing of the initiative and the placing of it on the ballot, and that in itself is a good thing, even if the outcome wasn't what a lot of people wanted.
Yeah, and you know, I think a lot of people may have voted to approve Referendum 1 just because when the judge reviewed the wording for the original ballot measure, she threw out most of the original wording. So a lot of people looked at what was left and they said, what is this going to do, you know, if we vote it down? It really won't stop the tunnel, will it?
Well,
and so there
was
this debate
and most of the city council and political leadership saying that a no vote wouldn't stop the tunnel.
Yeah.
And so, a lot of people remembering the stadiums.
Yeah.
And remembering the advisory vote in 2007 in which 70% of the electorate voted against the tunnel and it went ahead anyway, said, what's the point?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
They're going to ignore us anyway. And even though the tunnel passed, the fact that we're still talking about the stadiums 15 years on, that sort of betrayal it sticks in people's memories for a long time. And I think we're going to be talking about how the tunnel was rammed down people's throats for a long, long time in Seattle, even though it passed in this election.
Yeah, exactly. Also, some other results of the election that were interesting, too, was to see how the anti-incumbent fervor that was a big part of the elections. I'm thinking in particular King County Council District Number 6, where Jane Haig only got 38% of the vote against her challengers. If you combine Richard Mitchell's returns with John Crichton's, that's like 54% of the vote.
And that's
so she's
and that's
very
54%
vulnerable.
For declared Democrats in a Republican-leaning district.
Yes, exactly.
So it really tells you how Haig's abuses of power, and particularly not only her DUI a few years ago, but the fact that she first tried to cover up that DUI, and then it turned out that she abused the patrol officer involved as well. That's really come back to hurt her, and some other things have come back to hurt her as well. So she did not do well at all. The other incumbents that did not do well at all were Seattle school board members.
Well, yeah, but before we talk about them, I want to talk about Jean Godden's race for Seattle City Council.
Oh, go for it.
Because hers was very similar to Jane Haig's. Godden got 44%, but her three major challengers, Bobby Forsh, Michael Taylor Judd, and Maurice Claussen, if you put their percentages together, that's 56%. So she's also also equally vulnerable, I think, too, in the final. The person who got the most votes against her, Bobby Forsch, is a very credible challenger, and he has the support of most of the Democratic establishment in the city against Godin. So she very
And is also
clearly,
more progressive than Godin, I might
say. Yeah, so she very clearly has something to worry about for the November ballot. For Seattle School Board's job said, what I found really, really interesting is that, you know, turnout averaged about 30% for King County. For the city of Seattle city council elections, it was a little higher, around 35%. But for the Seattle School Board, turnout was 35% to 38%, showing how much people, how much more people cared about whether who was going to be representing them on the school board in their districts. Now, the incumbents, of course, took the majority of the votes in each of the races, but all of them are vulnerable. The only one who took over 50% was Peter Meyer in District 1.
And that was
one.
Barely over 50%.
And that was just barely over 50%. Sharon Peasley, the returns for Sharon Peasley and John Cummings, if you put those together, that's 48%. So he's vulnerable, too, in November. But for all the other districts, Sherry Carr only took 40%. That is lame.
Despite having a lot of money.
Yeah, Harry and Martin Morris took 41%, and Steve Sundquist only 43%. So they're all clearly vulnerable to being swept out of office come November. So that's the good news from the elections. Even if, say, for example, if you voted for Michael Taylor Judd, you might be disappointed that Bobby Forsch took more and will be facing Gene Godin in the final. Still, you know, he's much better than Godin and all of the school board.
Yeah, and if you supported Taylor Judd in the primary, Forsch was clearly a better outcome than Maurice Clausen, who actually had more money and was more widely expected to be the challenger for Godin. Forsch's making it through to the final was something of an upset and good news for progressives.
Yes, I think so.
All right. Well, let's move on. City Council was busy this week.
Yeah, the City Council voted to send a $60 car tab fee to the November ballot. This $60 car tab fee is a little bit cheaper than the $80 fee initially proposed. It will raise about $204 million over 10 years, but about half of that, about $100 million of it, is going to be for transit. Transit being not King County Metro Transit.
Yeah, define that transit.
Yeah, not King County Metro Transit, not Sound Transit.
Not buses. Not light rail.
But it's the bulk of that money is going to go to create a connecting link between the SLUT, the South Lake Union trolley, and the First Hill streetcar. So a single line system, actually a two line system now, that has a very small number of riders compared to the bus system in the city. Only 29% of the $60 car tab fee, or about $59 million, will go to address the $1.8 billion street maintenance backlog. And 22%, which is about $45 million, will go for pedestrian, that is sidewalks, bicycles, and for freight projects. So it'll be interesting to see whether Seattle voters will vote for the $60 car tab fee to tax themselves, primarily to create a link between two streetcars that very, very, very few people use.
Yeah, and not only a link that very few people use, but also a very regressive tax, because it's a flat tax regardless of the value of your vehicle. So if you have a Beamer, or if you have a, you know, old 1968 Caprice or something, you're still going to pay that $60. That's a flat tax. That's a problem, too.
Yes, it is. And thank you, Tim Iman, for the flat car tab fee tax.
All right. Moving on, King County and the death penalty.
Oh, yeah. The Sunday Seattle Times had a very, very interesting article that you don't the type of article you don't often see in the Seattle Times. It was it had a suggestion for one way to balance the King County budget. You could do away with the death penalty. The article was basically looking at how cities and localities and states around the nation are suspending the death penalty because of its high costs, but not so much in King County. King County is going against the national grain by continuing to pursue three very expensive death penalty cases. Christopher Monforth, who killed a police officer on Halloween night in 2009.
Allegedly.
Allegedly. And Michelle Anderson and Joseph McEnroe, the suspects in the death, in the murders of Anderson's family members on Christmas Eve in 2007. The cost of those three ongoing death penalty cases is $4.3 million and counting. It's most of that money's gone for expert witnesses, forensic analysis, special investigators, attorney costs, et cetera, et cetera. It all adds up during the years.
And that's before the inevitable appeals.
Yes, during the years, if not decades, of appeals that follow. A Washington State bar study from 2006 showed that death penalty cases routinely generate more than $500,000 more in initial trial costs than other murder cases, and at least $200,000 on average for appeals, and it's often much higher during the appeals process, depending on how long they drag on. Because most defendants are indigent or soon become indigent because of the high costs of their trials, taxpayers end up covering these costs. So you really have to ask, can we afford the so-called ultimate punishment? And I think in these times, the answer to that question is no.
Okay. Moving on, the Washington State Supreme Court ruling.
Oh, yes. The Washington State Supreme Court this week ruled that law enforcement agencies, that is, police departments in the state of Washington, are required to publicly release the records of their internal investigations against officers accused of police misconduct. The public has a, quote-unquote, legitimate interest in knowing how the allegations of police misconduct were investigated.
You think?
Yes, I do think so. And five of the nine justices ruled that officers who were exonerated can have their names removed from the record. SPD, the Seattle Police Department, currently has a policy, it's a long-standing policy, of not releasing records when an officer is exonerated. They keep the records secret so you don't know how the case was even investigated. That's clearly going to have to be changed. The Seattle Police Officers Guild currently has a court case to try and keep the Seattle Police Department from releasing the names of officers found guilty through internal investigations. That case probably should be dismissed at this point.
All right. And finally, on local, Mayor Mike McGinn, decision this week regarding sidewalk dining.
Yeah, this is of a piece with the extension of bar hours and also with food carts, where McGinn reached an agreement with the State Liquor Control Board, because, of course, a lot of the restaurants involved also serve alcohol, to allow restaurants to do sidewalk dining even if it's not immediately adjacent to the building that the restaurant is housed in. This is going to do a lot to be able to expand sidewalk dining and, in general, sidewalk and street life in Seattle. And, again, it's something that probably is going to trigger a backlash at some point from people who don't like the idea of street life in Seattle. But for those of us who like culture and like options in dining and whatnot, it's generally good news.
It also helps make a community a more walkable environment, gets people out of their cars, pulls people onto the street. And that can be problematic during times of an economic downturn because, in decades and centuries past, where do people organize demonstrations? Cafes and bars and restaurants.
Well, the other thing that it does is it helps with public safety to
yes,
have more people
does.
Out on the street.
I think it does as well. As a woman, I always find it a better walking environment to see a lot of people on the sidewalk than to see nobody.
Moving on to national, starting out with secure communities.
Yeah, this week a lot of immigrant and social justice groups protested an announcement by the Immigration and Customs Enforcement to expand the Secure Communities program. For folks who don't know what the Secure Communities program is, it was rolled out in a few cities in 2006. It was supposed to deport people with visa violations who had committed hardcore crimes. That was the idea. Anyone arrested on suspicion of a crime who police thought might be an illegal immigrant would have their fingerprints sent to the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security, which keeps track of immigration violations and then would turn the fingerprints and other information over to the INS in order to decide whether or not to pursue immigration charges.
ICE at this point.
Yeah, ICE. Anyway, On Tuesday, the American Immigration Lawyers Association published a report that shows most people deported under secure communities were arrested for minor violations, usually traffic infringements, although a couple of the cases they cited, one guy was arrested for burning leaves in his front yard and then deported, and another woman was put through the deportation process after she called police because her boyfriend was beating her. So, and what they found in total was that in 69% of the cases they studied, the illegal immigrants who were deported had no prior criminal history. 62% of them were close relatives of American citizens or legal permanent residents. So literally, they found that secure communities breaks up families.
And breaks up communities. It's,
yes.
It's a very Orwellian kind of,
exactly.
kind of name for a program. And when you hear that kind of Orwellian name, it should always set off warning signals. What are they not telling you?
Yeah. And so on August 5th, when Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director John Morton announced that cities and local communities could no longer voluntarily be a part of secure communities, that in fact the program was going to be rolled out everywhere nationally, whether cities and localities wanted it or not.
So there's no opt-out process.
There's no opt-out process anymore. By 2013, it's going to be a nationwide program. Immigration groups and social justice groups decided now's the time to protest this and see if we can't stop it. So this week was a big week for that.
And again, deportations are very much up under President Obama and the Obama administration. Once again, in this arena as well, discouragingly bad on civil liberties issues.
Part of Obama's immigration reform policy, I'm sure.
And yet, if you read the comment sections of the papers, you get the exact opposite impression, that Obama is not deporting enough people.
Yeah.
If you read the comment sections of the local newspapers, your brain will melt.
Well, that might explain a couple things. All right, let's move on. New study regarding Medicaid.
Yeah, a new report came out this week from the Inspector General of the Department of Health and Human Services. They've found that Medicaid pays much, much, much less for drugs than Medicare. Medicaid gets better discounts from drug companies because its discounts are set by law. Medicare, on the other hand, Medicare drug prices are negotiated between private insurance companies and the drug companies. Now, the Medicaid rebate averages about twice as much as the Medicare one, which means that private insurance companies are much, much, much less efficient than the government at negotiating lower drug prices. Now, Congress, when it added the drug benefit to Medicare in 2003, it did it specifically prohibited the government from negotiating drug prices on behalf of Medicare.
Which was a massive gift to the drug companies.
It was, and it turned it over to private insurers, in essence privatizing the drug program. About 30 million Americans get their drugs through Part D of Medicare, so that's a big cost to taxpayers. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the cost of Medicare's drug benefit will increase by at least 10% per year and be about $175 billion by 2021. So you have to imagine in your mind how much money could be saved if the government had the power to negotiate drug prices with the drug companies directly instead of having privatized it. That could go quite a ways towards helping plug the budget deficit.
All right. Moving along, I hope I get his name right. Who is Peter Simonyi?
Simonyi. Yes, he is. He was the vice president of Goldman Sachs. First of all, I want to talk about Daryl Issa. He's a Republican member of Congress, a very corrupt Republican member of Congress. He's also the chair of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, which has oversight over the financial services industry. And he has a staff person named Peter Haller, who helps write legislation overseeing some of that financial service industry. Well, it turns out, according to reports this week, that Peter Haller and Peter Simonyi are the same person. That's right. Mr. Simonyi left his position as vice president of Goldman Sachs in 2009, went to work for a lobby shop, and then went from there to working for Representative Issa under the name of Peter Haller. He adopted his mother's maiden name for his new position. Now, there's got to be something ethically questionable about this, I would think. But it really does raise a couple of very pressing questions. Number one, why would somebody take a pay cut from being a literally probably compensated millions of dollars a year to being a vice president for one of the largest financial service industry corporations in the world to being a lowly congressional staffer, which is often a job filled by, you know, ambitious 20-somethings before they go to entry work level for Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
number two, isn't it usually true that Goldman Sachs can get what it wants from people like Representative Issa just by picking up the phone? Why go to all this trouble? And number three, what is it in the legislation that is being written with the help of our good staff aide that is so important and so important to hide from the public eye that it would be worth going to all this trouble and having such a hands-on role?
Yeah, I think a book will be written eventually, or needs to be written eventually, about how much financial services companies and banking and the banking industry has poured into trying to stop changes from the Dodd-Frank financial reform bill, because this is going to be a whole chapter, I think.
Even though the Dodd-Frank bill actually in a lot of ways didn't go nearly far enough in its regulations.
It basically laid out a plan by which different government agencies would increase regulation on the banking and financial industry. And right now, when you look at somebody like what Peter Simonyi has done, you really see what the banking industry is doing in order to scuttle that regulation.
All right. Moving on, a terrorism plot this week in Tampa.
Yeah, we've talked on this show a number of times about the FBI going to extraordinary lengths to coax 17-year-olds or teenagers into fulfilling their jihadist fantasies. Well, this week we had a story of a 17-year-old in Tampa who already had a fantasy about blowing things up. He wanted to go back and blow up his local high school and was arrested. He was expelled from that high school a while back and was arrested with a number of pipe bombs and an elaborate diary outlining how he was going to kill all of these people, and in particular some of his former teachers. This is the sort of thing where the FBI wasn't really looking for this. This came totally randomly out of a tip from the public, but the FBI was probably busy looking for Muslim teenagers instead, and immigrant teenagers, rather than this all-American white kid from suburban Tampa.
Moving on, the West Memphis Three.
Yeah, the West Memphis Three, for folks who don't know, were three then teenagers who were arrested and convicted in 1993 of a triple murder in West Memphis, Arkansas, under very, very dubious circumstances. A lot of the testimony was third-hand scuttlebutt. The insinuation for a lot of it was that these were teenagers that were involved in a satanic cult and were doing ritual sacrifice of young kids as part of that cult at a time when, you know, that sort of hysteria was widespread.
Yeah. And mostly that came from the fact that these kids had long hair and listened to heavy metal music.
And wore black. Yeah, in a small southern town.
In a small southern town. And so there was this idea that they were these evil outsiders, et cetera, et cetera. So the evidence against them was very third hand. It was very suspect. There was no physical evidence, and they were convicted.
So 18 years on, after the Arkansas Supreme Court earlier this year ruled that there was new DNA evidence that's probably going to lead to a new trial later this year, prosecutors and the defense attorneys reached a deal under which the West Memphis Three would enter offered pleas, which is basically a way of pleading guilty without admitting guilt, and then be freed on time served. And that is what has happened. They are now freed. So for all of the people who have worked for the many, many years to try and get these folks out of jail. Obviously, people who were teenagers in 1993 are in their late 30s now, so they've lost a huge portion
about
of their lives. But
years.
In one case, one of the young men was still on death row, and his life was saved, and the other people were saved from having the rest of their lives in prison. So that is activism with a happy outcome.
All right, moving on to international, starting with the UK riots.
Yeah, we were going to talk about this last week, but, you know, now's a good time as well because the issue is not going away.
We ran out of time last week. Yeah, but yeah, it's still an issue, absolutely.
It's still an issue, absolutely, yeah. The people who were arrested for looting took all the headlines, but in fact, the so-called riots in the UK were started as an anti-police brutality demonstration that got a little out of hand. It really pointed out a big problem in society in the UK, but it's a problem worldwide as well. The growing difference in income between those on the bottom of the income ladder and those at the top, and the decreasing number of people who are in the middle. Much of the protests in the UK are because minority youth have an extremely high unemployment level, and these protests also followed on some very violent and very vigorous protests that happened just a month or two ago over a 300% hike in tuition rates in the UK because of the austerity budget that was passed by the Cameron government. These protests also follow on the phone hacking scandal in the UK, which has implicated not only Scotland Yard, but high level members of David Cameron's government.
Yeah.
And it really follows this feeling that people in the UK have of, well, if those guys can get away with it, you know, we should be able to get something for ourselves. So you look at these looters and you go, what were they doing, you know, in the street? You know, that's just because of police brutality, because of income inequality, because of high unemployment, that's no excuse. But remember who their so-called leaders are, who do the same kind of looting just out of the public eye.
Yeah, and again, all of these ingredients are present in the United States as well. And it's remarkable how many of these riots start when somebody non-white is shot and killed by law enforcement, which is what happened here. But the actual looting and riots themselves were remarkably multiracial. Transgenerational.
As is income inequality around the world.
Yeah, transgenerational. The thing that really everybody involved had in common was class.
Yes. And
was income. And again, as Maria said, the fact that you have in all of the so-called developed countries around the world, and particularly the United States as well, this widening gap between rich and everybody else, and the fact that everybody else is falling farther and farther behind, you're going to see more and more of this, and you have all the ingredients for it in the United States as well.
And we have corruption here too. When you see these big bankers and guys like Peter Simonier going from a position at Goldman Sachs to writing the rules in Congress for how his industry can operate, people start to think, well, you know, maybe I should be out there getting some of my own. You know, maybe I should be protesting in the street. Maybe I should just go down and take something because, God, the guys who make millions, that's what they do.
All right. Just a minute left. Briefly, Syria, Libya.
Yeah, you spend more time on either one of them. Both of them are deteriorating this week. In Libya, reports now, although we've heard some of these things before, about rebels on the verge of taking over Tripoli, and Gaddafi scrambling to find places to hide all of his various relatives and all of his various bank accounts. Not necessarily in that order.
With concerns that there may be infighting among the rebel groups in Libya as well.
And not only infighting, but also massive human rights violations. And it's been very messy all the way around in terms of the NATO campaign in Libya. A massive loss of civilian life in some incidents, including one on March 8th where some 85 people were allegedly killed. So it's been very, very messy and taken a lot longer, but it looks like he may be on the verge of leaving. And then the United States taking some very proactive steps for the first time in months in Syria this week, joining together with some other countries to impose sanctions, and for the first time actively call for the removal for Assad to step down. Meanwhile, Syria
it's
taken a very long while. Assad this week had said that the military would no longer fire on demonstrators. Not true. At least 18 more people killed in Friday demonstrations yesterday in Syria.
Yeah, including the shooting of some police officers and military personnel who refused to fire on civilian demonstrators were also shot.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. Where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org. It is a website full of news and blog comments and comics and stories of all sorts of things. You should check it out. www.eatthestate.org.